Last night, pre-flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space.
Yeah.
On such a timeless flight.
Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. And, yeah, I will make a correction. Vic had recorded the news this morning, and he said that the polls in the news report, he said that the polls open at 8. The polls open at 6. Just want to make sure you know that. The polls open at 6. The news was recorded this morning. So next time we play it again, I will let you know again that it's not 8 o'clock, it's 6 o'clock. So the polls open in Illinois at 6. Okay, just wanted it's a big thing. We want to make sure you know about that. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here till 4, keeping you company, keeping you informed, and we'll get through this. It's a weird, weird time right now. It's scary, but let's all just relax, and hopefully I can keep you, we'll definitely keep you informed, I'll keep you entertained, and we're here for you 24-7. We never go away. WGN is here 24-7. During this very, very strange time, but we'll get through it. Coming up a little bit later on, every morning at 2:30, we play some classic stand-up from The Tonight Show, The Johnny Carson Show, which you can watch on Antenna TV. We're going to go back to 1991 for some Tim Allen stand-up. Also, we got the penguins running around the Shedd Aquarium. Have you watched this footage, Tom?
It was a true delight.
It's so awesome.
The Shedd Aquarium is one of my favorite places on earth, and yeah, watching the little penguins run around was just, you know, it just makes you feel good.
Well, it does, especially at this time, because we're all freaked out and stuff, and then, you know, just to watch up some penguins walking around the Shedd Aquarium, it's fantastic. We have another edition of Ask Dr. Nick. I'm not a doctor, though. I only play one on TV. And also some facts about St. Patrick's Day, which it is St. Patrick's Day. Right now, happy St. Patrick's Day. Joining us for his monthly visit, Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and a space expert. If you have a space question or a space comment, talk or text us right now at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Hello, Rod.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
Well, you know, I was just calming down from all the California quarantines and everything and starting to feel pretty good. And then I tuned in and saw your shirt, and it set me back.
Oh. Do you know who this is?
Those eyes.
Do you know who?
I was talking to Tom. I couldn't tell right away. It looked like Stanley Kubrick after a really bad bender, but Tom told me who it was.
Yeah, so
that makes sense.
Legendary special effects makeup artist Tom Savini. And actually, Tom got me this shirt for my birthday, my producer Tom. Got me the shirt for my birthday.
So I'm trying to imagine you wearing that shirt sitting in front of a pink iMac, and it just isn't working for me. You know? It's not congruent at all.
That pink iMac is in storage, my friend, so I don't know. Yeah.
But
so,
you kept it, see?
Yeah, we got it. It's in a box, you know, somewhere. I don't know where, but it's there somewhere. So, and it's interesting because a lot of my plays are in there. Are stored and then
you wrote plays.
Yeah, I did. I wrote a bunch of plays, directed a bunch, and acted in a bunch of them too. So
you're such a Renaissance man.
Well, that's
know?
Just not even true. Rod, tell everybody about yourself and all that good stuff so that they can get acquainted with you here.
So I was born a few months before the space age began and grew up during that incredible time. And if you're alive then, you were either a young man. You're either a big fan of football or you want to be an astronaut. Some people both. I was really into the whole NASA thing. So I kind of became aware of it towards the end of the Gemini program, which was the two guys in the capsule orbiting Earth after Mercury. And then when Apollo, by the time Apollo started heading off in the late 60s, I was just hooked. And my parents had the good sense to let me ditch school on days that we were having moonwalks. So I stayed home and watched those. and lived through all that. And then as the shuttle era came around, I sort of meandered off in advertising for a number of years and worked on TV documentaries, the History Channel, and a little bit of visual effects work. And then by the mid-2000s, I was getting into writing books because it's really hard to tell the history of Apollo in 44 minutes on the History Channel, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, I'm going to try writing books. And much to my glee, for anybody who's ever thought about writing books, if you're working with major publishers, you know, once you kind of work into their trust zone, they just let you go and you get, you know, a few notes. Well, why don't you move? I've had one editor that was tougher than that, and he was right to be, because that book was a tough one. That was about a year and a half ago. But for 99% of them, you know, I will turn the stuff in, and I'll get a few notes about, can you put a footnote here? Can we move that paragraph earlier in the chapter? But they really just let you fly. So you got 280, 300 pages to tell your story. So, yeah, I'm not looking back. It's great fun.
Well, there you go. And how many books have you written now?
If you count the ones for NASA 17, I'm working on 18 now.
Yeah. And what's the book that you're working on now again? Remind us.
Well, so I was kind of noodling on a couple, and they don't have contracts yet, because once you get a contract, you've got a deadline, right?
Right.
Sometimes
right.
It's a matter of weeks.
Right.
Usually it's months. So I thought, I'm going to, you know, get these started and get well into them before I talk to any publishers about them. One is about living off Earth, with a specific focus on Mars and low gravity environments and all that's involved with radiation and reproduction and zero G and all that. Now, this was all as of a few weeks ago that I kind of had this planned out. That one involves a lot of travel. So
yeah,
suddenly that my time freed up, by golly.
That's
a lot
it.
Of talks
yep.
and conferences canceled. Yep. Yeah. So the other one is a sequel to Amazing Stories of the Space Age, and that's strictly archival and reference work. So that's what I'm working on now. And it's more kind of wacky things that were planned in the space age that never happened. Like, prior to the space age, actually, first chapter opens with the Nazis in World War II trying to figure out if they could build a huge orbital mirror to reflect the sun's rays down on New York and burn the city to a crisp, which is kind of fun, you know, when you think about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you imagine, I mean, they were literally going to go up, build this space platform with this enormous mirror, and they worked out the physics and the technology of it. It was theoretically possible, but it would have taken a couple thousand launches to do it. And you imagine these guys hopping around zero G with magnetic boots wearing lederhosen, and they were going to farm pumpkins up there for oxygen and food. I mean, can you imagine, you know, living on this thing for 6 months, burning down cities over the continental United States, or at least trying to, with nothing but pumpkin, you
right.
know, pumpkin pie, pumpkin tart, pumpkin soup, pumpkin salad. It would have been really grim. So that's kind of a fun story. It yeah. goes on from there.
All right. Very cool. And Ad Astra magazine. Tell us about that.
So Ad Astra is the publication of the National Space Society. It's a quarterly, and it's a full color. I think it's 64 pages now, and just a blast to do. And there's kind of a core message of space settlement in there, but when you talk about space settlement, you know, people immediately think of space stations or outposts on Mars or something, but it involves a lot of stuff. I mean,
yeah.
from satellites on out, you know, you need a lot of technology, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of development to do that. So we kind of cover the whole gamut, and then general space stories, some history, and, you know, I edit that, and there's actually only three of us there, so we all do a lot. But it's just, you know, I thought writing books was fun, but this has been just a real blessing. And the NSS is a good group to work for. They give me a lot of freedom with it. So it's been great. So we've got, let's see what's coming up this quarter.
Okay.
I had a guy do a profile on what it's like to be gay and be an astronaut. It turns out it was kind of difficult for a while. And we did a reflection on Hubble's 30 years in space and the Apollo 13 anniversary article. So that's kind of the cornerstone of this issue.
There you go. Ad Astra Magazine. All right, Rod Pyle, always keeping busy. And Rod is with us. And if you want to jump in, if you have a space question or a space comment, 312-981-7200. We have a lot of space stories to get to. Always a lot of fun to talk to Rod Pyle. 312-981-7200 is the number for talk and text if you would like to join us for some space talk. The Nick DeGiglio Show continues on 720 WGN.
But you won't let me love you. trust in you, baby. Can't you see that's what I'm trying to do?
Tuesday morning on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. Keeping you company, keeping you informed. We're all going to get through this. It's some weird stuff going on right now in the world. It's kind of scary, but we're here for you. And we're here 24-7 on WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Rod Pyle is our guest. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, and a space expert. And we love to talk space with Rod. Rod, we got some texts already coming in.
Wow, okay.
Okay, here we go. From the 715 area code, what do you think of the launching of the microsatellites that's been happening recently?
Depends on which microsatellites you're talking about. I know there was a university program that NASA was engaged in to encourage young people to build stuff out of university labs and so forth. So if that's what we're talking about, I mean, there's also the Elon Musk and the Starlink, but those aren't microsats. Those are actually the size of kitchen tables. It's great because what we're finding is you can now take off-the-shelf components, even like the components of an iPhone, for instance, drive a small sat very nicely, a CubeSat, they call them. They're about the size of a couple boxes of cigars put together, if anybody remembers what those look like. And you could do a lot. I mean, they actually have sent a couple of them out to Mars to do some relay work. NASA did that. And we're finding, besides doing stuff in orbit, which microsats have been doing, Planet Labs, a company that formed, I don't know, about 15 years ago, and they are one of those companies that provide the up-to-date images of Earth. So if you're Walmart and you're trying to figure out what kind of business targets doing on Black Friday, you can get shots of their parking lot from some of these companies. And a lot of those would be considered small sats or microsats. When you get down to CubeSats, though, you're talking about off-the-shelf components. They're cheap. And you can, they think, you know, go all the way up to going out and exploring other planets with them because stuff's just so miniaturized and needs so much less power than it used to that you just got this little tiny box and a couple of medium-sized solar panels and off you go. And it just brings the cost down so much. It's terrific. So I'm a big fan.
Oh, okay. Great. So now this is a tie-in here with another story. 872 says, do you know how close the meteor that is scheduled to pass us is going to be? And I got a story here that says April 29th, a large asteroid is expected to fly by Earth.
Yeah, I don't remember. That's what he's talking about, is an asteroid or she. I don't remember what the mileage is, but when we get nervous is when they're substantially in between the orbit of the moon and Earth. You know, if they pass outside lunar orbit, it's like, yeah, that's not even a near miss. But when they start coming in, so the moon's 240,000 miles away, if they're coming in at 80,000 miles or 10,000 miles or 5,000 miles, we start getting nervous, partly because there's, you know, margin of error there. You're hoping you're getting it right. It depends on how long you've been tracking it and along with, you know, what vectors and stuff. But So the answer is I don't know, but if it was much closer than a few thousand miles, we'd be hearing a lot more squawking about it. Yeah. Well, let me rephrase that. We would have until a week or two ago when the airwaves were suddenly taken over by the latest madness. But this underscores why it's important to start putting more money into planetary defense. We talked about this before. If we do spot something fairly large coming toward us, we can't do anything about it right now. You know, it's just, we just grit our teeth and hope it hits in somebody else's city, which is not a good way to go. So one of the things that the NSS talks about, the National Space Society and other groups and NASA as well, is starting to put some money into the hardware and techniques it'll take first to see these things. And NASA has been doing a very good job of that over the last 10 years because Obama ratcheted that budget up by 10 times. So we're spotting more and more of them. We realize we're in this tremendous shooting gallery with thousands of objects big enough to do us harm hurtling around at regular intervals for the most part. So if you can predict it, you know it's coming, the further out you can engage this thing, and you're not trying to blow it up because, you know, you're still going to have the same amount of stuff coming at you. It's just smaller if you manage to blow it up, which is very hard to do anyway. What you want to do is nudge it off course and get it going the other direction and make it some other planet's problem where there are any people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the big thing there.
And or you can just get Bruce Willis and his gang to...
You know, we talked about that. You're a fan of that one, right?
No, I hate Armageddon. Tom likes it.
I love Armageddon, man.
I hate that movie.
What about Space Cowboys?
Oh, I love Space Cowboys. That one I love.
Okay, so after we talked about that last time, I rewatched it because occasionally you and I differ on movies like that Abomination Interstellar. And
there's the monthly mention of Interstellar.
I know.
It always pleases Tom too because he can't stand that movie. And it's one of my favorites of all time.
I'm a person of routine. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
So I rewatched Space Cowboys and I thought, boy, this movie is really taking its time getting up to speed. I think the reason you like it and why I could kind of lean into it a bit is just the cast is so good.
Oh yeah, the cast is.
You know,
great.
If it wasn't for that cast, yeah, it would be. You know, so if it was the same cast as the other one as Armageddon, get this out of here. But the interactions with those guys are great. But you know what I did notice is it feels kind of like a studio movie a little bit. It's like that last gasp of the studio era, and you can get away with kind of clunky visual effects and obviously stuff shot in the sound stage and so forth.
Yeah.
And I think it was kind of pre, you know, when we got into heavy digital. So I guess that kind of felt to me like it was a little bit, but I'll respect it.
Summer of 2000 is when that came out. And, you know, and Clint Eastwood directed it, and he's known to be a guy who, like, does one take and then moves on. As a director, Clint Eastwood is known for how quickly he works. And, you know, in when you're doing a movie that takes place in space and has a lot of special effects, sometimes you can plow past that kind of stuff, I guess.
Well, not as fast as Roger Corman.
No, true. But, yeah, that cast, though, I mean, I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah. It's Tommy Lee Jones, right?
Yeah. Tommy Lee Jones,
Donald Sutherland, Clint Eastwood.
Donald Sutherland.
And James Garner.
Which was in every movie that was made for a while.
That's right. And James Garner, right?
James Garner.
God,
yeah.
What a great cast.
What a bunch of crazy old guys. Yeah. Well, and it gives guys, you know, I'm a little older than you, it gives us hope that we can still be kind of cool when we're over 50 or 60 or whatever.
Yeah. But I'm holding this article in my hand. They said that it's going to fly past Earth, this asteroid that we're talking about, at approximately a distance of 4 million miles. That's what they're saying.
That's really far.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's quite comfortable. So, yeah, we're good with that. Does it say how big it is?
No, it does not. But
because that's the other thing. You know, I mean, Chelyabinsk in 2013, I think it was like 60 feet. And that was the size of a, you know, medium-sized, like, tactical nuclear weapon. So that caused a lot of damage. Would have been worse if it had actually impacted. But when you start getting up to things that are in hundreds of meters and bigger, now you're talking about bye-bye city, in some cases bye-bye county if it's big enough, and that doesn't even include all the effects from the dust that goes up in the atmosphere and if it hits the ocean. I was writing something last year, I forget which book it was in, but I was writing about, I guess it was Space 2.0, I was writing about planetary defense and what would happen if something half the size of the dinosaur killer came in, and, you know, it's kind of put together this blow by blow. It hits the ocean. It goes and vaporizes a big hole in the water. Then the water comes rushing in. The coastlines are wiped out and steam in the atmosphere and, you know, nuclear winter and all that. Man, that was a depressing week.
That chapter
was just real.
I bet it was, man. Yeah. You
got to keep Ben Affleck on speed dial.
Tom, you're way too young to remember Skylab, but you know of Skylab?
I know of Skylab. It fell out of the sky, right?
Yes.
Very good, Tom.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah, fell out of the sky. But I remember that. People were kind of freaking out about that, Rod, I remember.
They were, and, you know, it kind of got a bad rap because, so it was up there from 73 on. And we stopped going up there in 74, I think. So three crews. It was an incredible set of missions. I mean, that thing was huge inside. It's still the biggest single space object ever in terms of interior volume ever put up in space. And so it was an incredible success. But so we stopped flying there because of budget issues and President Nixon and so forth. But NASA's plan was to send the shuttle up to boost it into a higher orbit and keep it going and keep using it. But the shuttle got delayed, as all government-run building programs like that seem to be, and over budget. And they still could have done it, but then the solar cycle was more active that year than normal in terms of how much energy it was emitting. Mm-hmm. And that heated up the atmosphere, and the atmosphere expanded, and that put more drag on Skylab, and down it came. And yeah, that was a pretty scary time.
I remember people just freaking. Where did it end up? In Australia, right?
Australia scattered out over the Pacific, and a few big chunks came in, but it did break up pretty well. I mean, it's you know, that another thing that when you talk to people about this, you begin to realize, or at least I have, that they think these things are built like battleships, and they're not. They're built like really flimsy airplanes with a rigid hull, but they're very, very lightly constructed. So yeah. Most of that stuff breaks up from aerodynamic forces. But a lot of big chunks did come in, and they found them in Australia, and some of them went onto the market and got sold.
Yeah. Unbelievable. All right, Rod. Rod Pyle is with us, and he is our space expert, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. Always great to talk about space with him. We got a lot of space stories. And any of your questions or comments, talk or text at 312-981-7200. Nick DiGiulio Show continues.
Pennies in a stream, fallen leaves of sycamore, moonlight in Vermont, I see finger waves. Ski trails on a mountainside, snow light in Vermont.
Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 4 o'clock. It's a Tuesday morning. Coming up at 2:30, classic stand-up from the Tonight Show, Johnny Carson Show, that you can watch on Antenna TV every night. Tim Allen from 1991 we're going to listen to. We're going to talk about those penguins running around Shedd Aquarium. Another round of Ask Dr. Nick, and then some facts about St. Patrick's Day. Right now we're with Rod Pyle, our good buddy. Author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and to answer any and all of your space questions and talk about some space stories. We're keeping an eye on everything that's happening in the world. We're here with you 24/7 during this kind of a scary time, but we're going to get through this. Everybody just do everything that's just be smart, be safe, and we'll get through this. Rod Pyle is with us. Hi, Rod.
Hello.
So there's this website that's going to let you relive Apollo 13 in real time?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting project. This guy works at NASA. His name's Ben Feist and at Johnson Space Center. And he decided for Apollo 11, he wanted to put up a website that would do a couple of things. I mean, the key thing you're talking about is it goes to the anniversary date, and at that moment of launch 50 years ago, showed the launch of the rocket as we saw it, and then followed the mission for the next 4 or 5 days. And so he's done it again with Apollo 13, and he's got Apollo 17 up. So you can go there now and click on this stuff and see everything, or you can wait until he does it in real time, which is kind of neat because it just paces it out, and it makes you feel like you're actually in the moment there.
Wow.
He had access, of course, to all kinds of cool stuff, and it's harder than it sounds because you go to NASA, if they've got archives, they still have some at Johnson Space Center, some of it's across the street at the University of Houston at Clear Lake, some's the National Archives in Maryland, so it's kind of all over the place. And I was there recently in Clear Lake looking up stuff from the Mercury Gemini days, and they don't have a lot of money to archive this stuff. It's not a budget priority, so you go into this room and there's all these boxes, and the curator does the best they can, but it's like you're saying, okay, what's on that wall? I think those are tapes from the 60s. Well, that's pretty broad, you know. So it's a lot of work to do this. And he went through, what did he tell, like 8,000 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's got a window with a timeline, and it's got a video window on the left and a bunch of assets down the lower right. So you actually see the coverage that we saw if you were watching CBS or NBC or ABC, which was it back in the day. You just had those three networks pretty much. You see it as we saw it then with the kind of blurry, crummy, you know, 400-line TV, NTSC TV signal and all that. And it's fun. It's a real pleasure to be able to sort of stroll back through history.
Wow, that's really cool.
It is. And Apollo 13, of course, will be interesting because it got real urgent there for a while.
Yeah.
Between the Earth and the Moon, then the side of the back half of the command/service module blows out, and we don't know what's going on, and Mission Control is going nuts to try to figure out, because they had all these options to try and decide, well, should we fire up the main engine and try and shorten the trip so that they start looping back to Earth before they pass the Moon, but we think that engine might have been damaged or might explode, and we'd have to let go of the lunar module to do that, and that's a lifeboat and so forth. So thank God they made the right decisions, but I was just writing an article on that for this British magazine called Sky at Night and going through it again. And I hadn't really looked at the story for a couple of years. And, you know, we all get used to the movie Apollo 13, which is great, and prayers for Tom Hanks and his wife because they've got coronavirus, which is scary. But the movie was, you know, it was an amalgamation of facts here and there. There's a little, not fictionalization, but there's some compression, let's put it that way. So when you really look at what happened and what decisions they made and how calm that room stayed, I mean, Mission Control, the average age of a control flight controller there was 26. Ooh. And they're making these life and death decisions. Gene Kranz was one of the old guys at 37. I think Chris Kraft was 41 or something. So they're like children to me, you know?
Yeah.
And they're making these life and death decisions, and they just played it perfect all the way down the middle. It's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool. And this guy is Ben, what's his name? Ben Feist?
Ben Feist, yeah. He and a few other guys, and I think it was a volunteer effort, if I recall, from the first one. So they've got the transcripts you can also page through, and then, of course, the video footage, like I said, and audio recordings. And I think they were part of that group that helped bring out the Mission Control audio tapes. We'd always just heard them in two-track, you know. Turns out there's something like 16 or 32 tracks of all the different consoles that you can switch between and pot one up and pot the other one down so you can hear what the guy who's monitoring fuel pressures is saying and all that. So he did a bunch of that work. It just makes for a really spectacular presentation.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That is very, very cool.
Yeah,
it is. Got some texts coming in. My mom knew some 715 area code. My mom knew Jim in Maryland, and I have a letter on NASA Apollo 13 stationery from Maryland in response to a letter from my mom. It was mailed as the mission unfolded, and my mom had written Maryland a letter of support.
Wow. So this is Marilyn Lovell we're talking about, Jim's wife. So she took time to write back to this lady's mom in the middle of that?
Yeah. And it was on Apollo 13, NASA Apollo 13 stationery.
I will buy that letter right now for $15. Cash.
15 cash. No, wow. Joke. Yeah, no, and that's, you know, that's pretty amazing.
It is. You speak about collectibles. I mean, especially if it was signed by Marilyn, that makes it more valuable. There was a guy, I was at a conference a couple of years ago. This guy brought out this thing that looked like a dried trachea. It was this little cloth tube with a Y fitting on it. But it had flown on one of the early Apollo 5, I think Apollo 7. It's, you know, an oxygen line or something. It's a hunk of hose about 2 feet long. And it was valued at $120,000, I think, because it had been in space.
Wow.
And it didn't look like much. You know, a helmet, we get it. You know, if you get a geology hammer from the moonwalk, that's going to be probably $500,000 or $1 million.
Yeah.
But a little piece of cloth trachea, I don't really get it, but... Yeah, that stuff's worth a lot of money, so she ought to hang on to that.
Absolutely. That's really great. 715 says, we've talked about this, Rod. I've read Musk's satellites are a problem for astronomers. Any insight?
So if you go on space.com, there's an op-ed I put up there yesterday or the day before. I didn't write it. I edited it, but it's got by a guy named Dale Scran. He's the chairman of the NSS. And it's about that exact topic. So the concern is, we got with this launch that's happening tomorrow morning, we hope, SpaceX will have 200 of these little satellites up. They're called Starlink. And they're small satellites in very low orbit, so they're going to provide broadband service, which is great. But they're kind of reflective. He's trying to make it a little darker and less reflective, but they're reflective. So if you're an astronomer, and you're looking at something in deep space, and you're taking this long exposure, and suddenly, whoop, this little thing looks like an airplane just flew through your photograph with the lights flashing, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a big problem for people. Radio astronomers have issues because these things are, of course, sending out all kinds of electromagnetic radiation. So, and there's only so much Musk can do. Now, his plan is to have somewhere between, I think the number now is up to 30 or 32,000 of these things, because it's going to take that much to get complete, deeply saturated coverage all over the planet, which is his goal. And there's a lot of benefits to that. But if you look out at any patch of night sky with some kind of optical assistance, you're going to see ding, 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 the stuff going by. Mm-hmm. So astronomers are really unhappy about it. So part of this op-ed was saying, you know, this may just be the age where we realize, okay, you know, it's time to fly more space telescopes and let researchers and even public researchers, you know, motivated amateur astronomers, have time on these things, and the Earth telescopes have to deal with it. And also, to be fair to SpaceX, there's been talk of them putting some money into helping develop software for these long exposure photographs, because they're all digital now, to be able to filter this stuff out. But yeah, it's a problem, and the astronomers are not happy about it, and I can't blame them.
Yeah, okay. You know, here's a 724 has this insight question. Since, for all intents and purposes, the universe is infinite, isn't its center an arbitrary designation?
Paging Dr. Einstein, come in. You know, that's almost a metaphysical question. I always thought the center of it was me. I can't believe somebody would think otherwise. I have no idea. That's a really good question. Yeah. Because everywhere we look, you know, what's confusing, always been a little confusing to me about this, is everywhere we look, they're all moving away from us like we're at point zero, but we know we're not, right?
Yeah.
So the whole thing's expanding, and it's speeding up, which also sort of defies logic. And then you get this conversation about dark matter and dark energy and anti-love and what else they're talking about this week. And it's evolving so fast that you really just got to be devouring it. And it's kind of interesting. I got an assignment with Space.com to review all the episodes of the new Cosmos season. So I've been watching those and watching Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, the explainer, do these things. And, you know, the grasp this guy has is just, it makes my brain hurt. I feel like my Labrador when I listen to him talk, because he's just got such a range of intelligence that he could talk about this. And I find him much more compelling in person than on TV, actually. But they're good. It's really, if you get a chance to see it, they just started airing them, I think, last week.
Okay.
And they're going to air one a week. They're just sensational. And visually, they're just unbelievably good.
That's great. All right. Rod Pyle is with us, and we're talking space. If you have a space question or a comment, 312-981-7200. Rod's an author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Astro Magazine. Joins us once a month. It's always a good time and always informative to talk to Rod. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Nick DiGilio Show continues.
Midnight at the Oasis. Send your camel to bed. Shadows painting our faces. Traces of romance in our heads. Heaven's holding a half moon. Shining just for us. Let's slip off.
That's Maria Muldaur, right? This is her only hit, I think. That was a big song. Very popular. All right, it's Nick DiGilio here, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Here until 4 o'clock, keeping you informed, keeping you company, and keeping you entertained. And we're here 24/7 at WGN. We're here to inform you, keep you company, and help you out through this pretty crazy time. But we'll get through this. Everybody just follow the rules, stay calm, and everything, you know, we'll just get through this. It's a weird time, but we'll do it. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And Rod Pyle is with us. He is editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and we're talking space. Rob, we got another text here.
Well, let me just real quick give you a quick analogy. So I looked this up because I want to make sure I was kind of getting it right. So, Everything's moving away from everything else. So this article out of University of California, Riverside, says, imagine a two-dimensional ant, that's a mind-bender right there,
yeah,
that lives on the surface of a perfectly spherical balloon. From the ant's point of view, as the balloon's being inflated, everywhere on the surface looks the same. There's no center on the sphere's surface, nor is there an edge. The ant will see its two-dimensional universe expand.
Oh.
Does that help at all?
I don't know if that helps. But it's certainly mind-bending.
Okay, let's watch Interstellar instead.
Yeah, exactly. That explains everything. It's a follow-up text, Rod. The woman who has that letter says, $20. I'm only kidding, because you offered $15.
Oh, got it. She had me going for a minute.
It says the letter is signed by hand, but the rest is typed.
Well, that doesn't matter. Yeah, it's a real signature. So, and you know, back then, of course, as you probably remember, typewriters were all unique, and the keys made impressions of the paper. I remember I was telling somebody asked me about agents the other day. I was remembering my first agent, who was a TV movie guy named Sal Vecchio. And actually, Quentin Tarantino licensed his name to use in one of his movies.
Is that right?
He thought it was such a cool name. Yeah. And Sal used the typewriter and onion skin paper. This is in the 80s, so we had all graduated to basic word processors then. But you're always telling you got a letter from Sal because all the dots on the I's were punched out. They were holes. It looked like a computer punch card or something. It was like he was typing in Morse code. So,
all right. We've got some space stories here. And if you want to jump in, talk or text us, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. NASA's Future Monster rocket is once again over budget, behind schedule. What's going on here?
SLS. So this is the Space Launch System, which is their follow-up to the shuttle. And this thing's been kind of going on in various forms. It really, if you take it all the way back, its DNA all the way back since about 2004 when George W. Bush started the Space Exploration Initiative. So we were going to have this rocket called Ares. And it's going to have four engines, probably repurposed shuttle engines, the big tank and boosters on the side and so forth. And then that got canned in 2010 because they couldn't get enough money together to do a lunar program. And then we did the asteroid redirect mission for a few years under Obama. And then Trump came in and said, now we're going back to the moon. And so this SLS rocket, which has been kind of trundling on, it's interesting because it's being built as kind of a new generation Saturn V, but it didn't really have a specific mission. So they're building this rocket that didn't have a mission. It's huge, heavy lift. It's actually, in its final version, more powerful than the Saturn V. But it's being built primarily by Boeing and a company called Aerojet, and Northrop Grumman also are working on various components. But Boeing's the main contractor.
Yeah.
And, you know, all you got to do is say Boeing, and everybody kind of goes, oh, I get it. So they're having a lot of problems, and the management control has just been not good. So NASA's got these reports. This one is from the internal auditor, but they also get them from the Office of Management and Budget, too. And the reports keep coming back year after year as saying, you know, this thing's over budget, behind schedule, we're seeing all these management problems. NASA, you keep paying them. You even have given them some bonuses on things that have been late and over budget. What's the deal? At this point, you're not going to get the moon until 2030. And NASA says, well, it's hard. You know, we haven't built a big rocket in a long time. And the other problem with this thing is, besides being expensive and over budget, and now it's not going to fly until 2021, is that it's expendable. So you fly this rocket up, and the main stage drops off as the thing's heading for orbit, and it goes in the ocean and crashes, and that's it. And those four shuttle engines at the bottom are really expensive, and we've only got, I think, 16 of them left in the inventory. So after the first four flights, we have to start building them again. SpaceX has shown the way, as has Blue Origin under Jeff Bezos, to bring rockets home, land them, wash them off, gas them up, clean out the ashtrays, and fly again. And that's what we ought to be doing. So there's a whole bunch of reasons that people aren't too keen on this. And I'll add one more thing, which is Boeing just flew the test flight of their Starliner capsule, which is the competition for SpaceX to take astronauts up to the space station, hopefully later this year, early next year. SpaceX on schedule. Boeing is not any longer. During that test flight, they had a number of anomalies, and in doing a review, NASA found 61 problem areas. A couple of them could have been fatal. So,
jeez.
Yeah, it's in trouble all the way around. Yeah, and you know what's weird? We talked, I think, last time about this House bill, H.R. 5666, that's trying to modify the NASA budget. Yeah, And it really favors Boeing and the other big old school contractors and really punishes SpaceX and Blue Origin, who are the ones who are making the biggest strides and forcing those big old companies to become more innovative and agile. And, you know, don't have any intel on it, but it sure feels like somebody's been talking to somebody with a pat on the back. So I wish that would stop.
Mm. So this SLS program, how much are we talking has been spent on this?
They project $17 billion, I think it's $10 billion spent so far. It's $2 billion over now. By the time it's done, they expect it to be, these auditor supports, about 60% over the original budget of $11 billion. Could be as much as $23 billion. And the whole program with Orion could be as much as $50 billion. Now, to keep this in perspective, though, if you adjust the dollars, it's still somewhere between half or a third of what Apollo cost in 2020 dollars. So it's a less expensive program than that. But then on the other hand, you see people scratch their heads going, yeah, but we did this before.
Yeah.
Why is it so hard to do it again? And part of the problem is a lot of those guys have died or are certainly retired. A lot of the paperwork is gone. And there's just some stuff we don't know. So when they were trying to decide if they could rebuild a few years back the engines that we used on the Saturn V, they actually had to go into to the museums and measure the parts because they didn't have good enough schematics to go back and machine them from scratch. So there's brain drain. There's a lot of different factors. But the bottom line is, you know, just it can't cost this much because on the big end, if SpaceX gets their Starship going, which is the big rocket he's working on now that's blown up a couple of times, but in the last test it didn't, then all this just becomes a moot point because that'll be a tenth or less the price to fly, a tiny fraction of the cost to design and build, and he's doing it with his own money. And then you've got this kind of albatross of a rocket. So don't know what's going to happen there.
Okay. We got a text here from Trucker Jim. And I want to give a shout-out to all the truckers out there who are bringing supplies to the stores as we need them and driving through the night out there helping us out. I want to give them another shout-out. It says, hey, Nick, I stumbled across a movie yesterday called The Dish. I found it a thoroughly entertaining and funny movie. I wonder if you or Rob have seen it and what you thought. Also, how accurate is it, because it was based on actual events? Do you know?
So I haven't seen it, but I know it's, I think it's about the dish in Canberra, Australia.
Yep.
Back in the space race, bringing down the signals from the Apollo program, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And as far as I know, it's very accurate. People loved it. And Canberra was kind of in the line of fire during the moonwalk because it was getting the signals for a big portion of that. And so they were the ones that got us this first television picture of Neil Armstrong stepping off the lunar module.
Yeah.
And it was upside down for a few minutes, and then it wasn't. Right. Somebody remembered to throw a switch in California. Unfortunately, some of the, as I recall, those original recordings, because they were shooting film off of a CRT display.
Mm-hmm.
And also shooting television at the same time. So I don't remember if it was the film or the video recordings that were lost, but they restored it since then. It looks pretty good. But, yeah, the movie was supposed to be sensational, and I'm glad he brought it up because that reminds me of it was something I'd been meaning to watch.
It's actually really good. It is a really good. Tom, you've seen it?
I've seen it a million times. One of my dad's favorites, mainly because of the scene when they're supposed to play the American National Anthem, and they play the theme from Hawaii Five-0.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no.
But which one would you rather hear? I mean, let's be honest here.
So
that theme was wicked good.
Yeah, no. It's a very entertaining movie. What year are we talking about that movie? Is it like the early 90s?
Came out in 2000.
2000. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it stars Sam Neill.
Yeah,
yeah.
That good old Sam Neill.
And have you ever seen Sam Neill in anything you didn't like?
No, I love him in everything.
I got my last Carpenter movie in a few weeks ago, the Mouth of Madness.
Oh, man, In the Mouth of Madness.
Hadn't seen it. In the Mouth of Madness. And, you know, probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much, except that Sam Neill is just great in everything he does.
He is, and he's really, really great in that. Like, he really gets to go nuts in that movie.
Oh, man, those scenes in the asylum?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing stuff. All right, Rod.
Hey, we like the same movie.
How about that? How'd that happen?
That is cool.
Rod Pyle is with us. More space stories to talk about. If you have comments or questions concerning the space, Rod is here to help out, and it's always fun to talk to Rod, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. We will continue our conversation here on 720 WGN.
bought her this and that, and how much you done spent. I swear she must believe it's all hell to say. Hey, boy, better bring a check around.
Yeah, man, Boss Skaggs. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here until 4 o'clock, and we are keeping you company. We are keeping you informed through this little scary time that we got here, and but we'll make it through this. Follow all the rules. Keep yourselves clean. Wash your hands. Stay in. Avoid contact, there's enough supplies out there for everybody. Just don't hoard. That's all we're saying. No panicking. Stay inside. Watch some TV. Read a couple of books. That kind of stuff. So there we go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up at 2:30, we've got our classic stand-up from the Johnny Carson show that we play every morning. And you can watch the Johnny Carson show every night on Antenna TV. And we're going to go back to some classic Tim Allen from 1991. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rod Pyle. By the way, the polls open up at 6, not 8. So Vic was reporting it that they open at 8. They do not open at 8. The polls open at 6 a.m. They open at 6 a.m. Just make sure you want to make sure you know that. Rod Pyle is with us. He is the author, journalist, and editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. We're talking space. 312-981-7200. All right, Rod.
Hey, I just realized something. Excuse me for breaking in, but I have never mentioned that the NSS is a chapter-based organization, and they got a huge, I've never gone to any of their meetings, but they've got a huge chapter in Chicago.
Oh, they do?
So I just thought I'd throw that out there. It's called the Chicago Society for Space Studies, and people that are affiliated with it say they do a lot of really great stuff. Probably not for the next few weeks, but after that, might be worth checking out.
All right, cool. Thanks for telling us about that. All right, I love this headline. Weird space lettuce is totally healthy and apparently tasty.
Weird space lettuce. I mean, how could you go wrong with that? So they've been doing experiments growing various, I guess you call them, micro crops up on the space station. And apparently red romaine is one of the ones that works really well. There's another name for it, but that's one I can pronounce. So between 2014 and 2016, they grew a couple of batches of this. And they don't just grow it out in the open. They grow it in an enclosed box. Looks like a big, I don't know, about half the size of the, like, what musicians transport their sound equipment in. And it's got LED lights in it, so it's got artificial light. And apparently it tastes pretty good. They kept half of it there. They shipped the other half home. The half they kept there, they let the astronauts eat. And they said, yeah, this is like, you know, baby lettuce that you get in one of those overpriced salads at a nice restaurant. They also grew a control crop down on Earth. I thought it was kind of interesting because one of the flights where they grew lettuce in the station, Scott Kelly was up there. Mm. His brother Mark was down on Earth, and they were doing that controlled experiment, if you remember, where Scott stayed up every year. Mark's there. So it's sort of like, you know, lettuce astronauts. You have a control on the ground for both of them. It's just one of those things that clicked in my head because I'm odd that way. But anyway, so it's been successful, but it's hard to do because when you think about it, it's zero G, right? Well,
yeah.
Normally you plant a seed in the ground, you pour water on it, it percolates down. That all counts on gravity. So when you do it up in space, water tends to just glob up. So, for instance, if you cry, it just creates a little kind of a blob in your eye. It doesn't run down your face, which is something to watch for in movies in zero G, even, by the way, if somebody cries.
Yeah.
So they had to figure out a way to make that work. So they've got this kind of suspended fabric or batting sort of stuff, and then little bags of the seed and a little bit of soil. And the water wicks in on this substrate and goes into the bag and keeps it just damp enough. So it's hard to do, but it works. There is one other interesting aspect of this, which wasn't specifically addressed in this study, which is why it's in the news now. The study just came out saying, yeah, it works. Some crops, if you germinate them in orbit, some of the junk DNA actually turns on, the stuff that we thought for a long time didn't do much. It was just hanging around a double helix, minding its own business.
Yeah.
Actually switches on, and some crops can become altered by that and be brought back to Earth, and they're more resistant to cold or to climate change and things like that. So you can actually do some, I wouldn't call it evolution, but alteration of these core seeds, these crops, and bring them home and have advantages on Earth. So that was something I was kind of interested in. The company has been trying to commercialize it for years.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, whenever I see stories about them trying to, you know, grow food or anything like that in the space station or in space, I immediately think of the potatoes in The Martian. Like, the first thing I
think
of.
I have real problems with that scene.
Yeah. All he ate was
because
potatoes.
If you were within, I mean, so you bring in the dirt, right? You build a little dirt box, you plant the potatoes. That dirt hasn't seen rain in 100 million years, right? So it's really dry. It's highly eroded because of all the windstorms. So it's the finest dust known. I mean, it's like the texture of smoke. And if you get that stuff in your eyes and mouth, because it's filled with oxidizing chemicals, your lips would flare up and your eyes would swell closed and your nose would swell closed. You'd have a really bad day. And he's there gardening and digging, chucking around and all that.
Right.
Not to mention that the hole in the side of the container is being held closed by taped-on plastic sheeting.
Right,
that we know
right.
That. I mean, we already know that story. It's like, I'm sorry, there's a 100-to-1 pressure differential between the inside and the outside. And, okay, sure.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah. All right.
But it was a good movie.
Yeah, I enjoy that movie. I like The Martian. I thought it was really good.
I did, too.
Yeah, how about that?
Okay,
all right.
Let's shake hands. No, we can't shake hands.
We got a call here from John. Hi, John. Go ahead.
All right.
Ron, can you talk about Beetlejuice again? When do you think it's going to supernova?
Are we talking about Beetlejuice?
Yeah.
Yeah, Beetlejuice in the constellation Orion.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk about that, and it the reason they're worried about that is it's been dimming. And they've traced it dimming and brightening over the years for, I don't know, decades. But it got much dimmer this time, like by a factor of 2.5 or 3 in a different period of time. And so astronomers are going, uh-oh, we're going to have a supernova. And if it did supernova, it wouldn't hurt us, but it would be the brightest object in the sky after the sun for a couple of weeks. So astronomers got really excited. And we hate to see a star die, but they got really excited. But as it turns out, another theory has emerged that it probably won't, and it's between hundreds of thousands and millions of years from, on average, where that end of life would be. Large red stars like this one, like Betelgeuse, throw off a lot of material because of the part of their life cycle they're in. So they think there's this enormous cloud of dust around it that's actually causing it to dim, and that's probably what's happening. It's still got a good long life ahead of it, but nobody knows for sure.
What happens if you say its name 3 times?
It's really creepy. A little guy shows up in your train board.
That's it. All right, John. Thanks
a lot.
Take care.
Thanks, John. And I love that movie, by the way.
Me too.
Just a romp.
Yep, I loved it. And, you know, they're actually, aren't they making a sequel?
Well, they were supposed to do a sequel way back, Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, but that didn't exactly happen.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
That'd be hard to recapture that, I think.
We got a text here from 773 area code. Says, years ago, Andy Griffith had a show about a space junk man. It was called Salvage One, by the way.
God, yes.
Is there any money in space junk?
Oh, that's a good twist. So you remember the show he's talking about?
I do. Yeah. It was like a late 70s. It was terrible.
Yeah, it was based on Robert Truax, who was trying to build his own rocket out of, you know, surplus parts and so forth. My favorite scene was when the rocket takes off, clearly powered by 4 fire extinguishers, and there's people standing like 30 feet away clapping, who would have been incinerated and scrambled and decomposed and so forth. But all's well, you know, because it's Andy Griffith, and you got to love Andy Griffith.
Yeah.
So there isn't now. There will be. So space junk, as we know, there's, you know, millions of tons of stuff up in low Earth orbit, and there are old exploded rocket stages and defunct satellites and paint chips and globs of frozen fuel and God knows what else. So right now we're trying to figure out, various space agencies, how to get this stuff out of there, because it's a hazard to navigation, and that people get nervous about what Elon Musk is doing with Starlink, because there's got to be a bunch more satellites up there, but those are all designed to deorbit themselves at the end of their useful life.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that's up there ain't going anywhere. It's just staying there. So there's various schemes, from electromagnetic dragging cables that would cause it to collect and slow down and deorbit, to actually trying to use nets and metamaterials and all kinds of other things. But the real, to address the question specifically, the gold mine here is, this is mostly metal. It's mostly titanium and aluminum. So it's up there already. So rather than launching this stuff for $50,000 a pound, let's go up there and use what's there. So if you can collect that stuff and then smelt it and make it into something else, you are going to be the first trillionaire, I assure you.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There he's
at. Better than radio, just by a little bit.
Exactly right. Then Andy Griffith was on to something then.
Oh, God. Andy, can I have my bullet now?
Yeah. All right. Rod Pyle is with us. We're talking space. If you want to jump in here, we're going to talk with Rod a little bit longer here. You have a space question or a comment, 312-981-7200. And you can go to rodpylebooks.com for more information about the stuff that he's written. And more space talk coming up here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and just want to let you know that we're here for you, that we're going to keep you company, we're going to keep you informed, and WGN Radio is here 24/7. We're not going anywhere, and we're all going to get through this together. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rod Pyle is my guest for his once-a-month visit, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. All right, Rod.
Okay, what's up?
Okay, so I have a headline here. This machine turns urine into water in space.
Yeah, I figured we had to do either that one or the tipped Uranus case.
Yeah.
Both have funny words on them. So, yeah, so it's really expensive to fly water up into space. With the shuttle bays, it was like, I think, $10,000 or $12,000 a gallon. Now it's actually more. It's about $50,000 per gallon,
good,
which is really expensive.
Good Lord.
I thought the number was much lower than that, but I just looked it up, yeah.
Jeez.
So, you know, so to ship up enough for an astronaut or two to drink for a day costs a fortune, so you want to reuse it as much as possible, right? Which is kind of gross, but they have machines that will clean it and break it down and make it drinkable. So they've had devices up on the space station for 20 years now that were two machines linked together. One had filtration systems and so forth. The other was an oxygenator. And it was able to process the water so it tastes okay and it doesn't have any icky things in it. But they were kind of high maintenance. And the problem with the space station now is that it's, like I said, it's 20 years old. It's requiring a lot of repair and maintenance. Up to half the astronauts' time is spent doing maintenance on the space station.
Yeah,
so they want to minimize that as much as possible. So they just set up this cool new machine that's simpler and more streamlined. It's got more robust parts. And it's funny, you know, I was talking to Bill Gerstenmaier, who used to be a bigwig at NASA, charging human spaceflight, and we were talking about this kind of stuff. And he said, you know, the funny thing is, you can build a machine like, say, a life support system on Earth and test it to death, and it works great, and then you put it up in space, and it fails in 3 weeks. It's just one of those things. Zero-G is a tough environment.
Yeah.
So they figured out what was wearing on the original one and boosted that stuff up and lightened up the rest of it, and like I said, streamlined it and made it work better. So, yeah, this is going to be the new drinkable pee machine.
Wow.
And they also reprocess sweat and so forth that collects just, you know, any humidity that collects in the humidity collectors, they also reprocess. So basically any water, it's to the point where you can't use alcohol-based hand sanitizers because the alcohol will get trapped just in the vapor that comes off your hands and reprocessed,
sure.
And it taints the water. Yeah, so they got to be careful what they do.
Wow.
So, boy, talk about efficiency, you know?
Well, you know, have you seen the movie Waterworld, Rod? With Kevin Costner?
Sorry to say, I did survive it, yes.
Yeah. Well, see, actually, that's a movie that I love.
Come on.
No,
really?
I do. I love Waterworld. I love it. I'm pretty sure that's why my first ex-wife left me, because she came home three times and saw me watching Waterworld. She's like, what the hell are you doing? I can't live with a man.
Were you wearing, like, we were wearing buckskin and stuff.
No, no. But I don't know if you remember. Well, you probably don't remember. At the beginning of the movie, Kevin Costner's got a device on his boat there that that he pees into, and then it becomes water. That's at the.
Yeah, why not?
That's one of the first scenes in the movie.
Wouldn't you rather reprocess that than just desalinate seawater?
Yeah.
Which is all around you. Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't he do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was kind of a strange film.
Yeah, it was a very weird movie. But,
it did give us the phrase jump the shark, which we've gotten to use for the rest of our lives since then, and that's good.
No, you know? Jump the shark comes from Happy Days.
Oh, I thought it came from Waterworld.
No, it comes from Happy Days. It's the episode where Fonzie water ski jumps over a shark.
Oh, well, that makes more sense.
And that's when the show, that's when they said the show got really bad. So anytime a show gets bad, it jumps the shark. And that comes from Happy Days. Yeah.
Okay, pulling my foot out of my mouth. What's next?
We got a couple of texts here. 434 says, okay. What should we call the members and officers of the Space Force?
Oh, that's a good question. So they're trying to figure that out. There's a lot of money and time. There's actually an interesting radio show called The Space Show that a guy does out here in California. And it's on member stations and streams.
Yeah.
And he had a gentleman named Steve Quast on there, who was formerly of the Air Force, who's big in the Space Force, fairly outspoken. And, you know, his contention was they're spending way too much time and effort on worrying about command structure and all this infrastructure stuff and not dealing with getting the job done, in his opinion. And I think he's probably right. So I don't know what they're going to end up with that. There's actually been some talk about naval ranks would make more sense for various reasons.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
And, of course, they're still trying to figure out the uniforms. I mean, they came up with a patch, a logo, which looks very much like the Star Trek for the Enterprise.
Yep.
And then we were all waiting with bated breath for the uniforms. We thought, man, they look like, you know, the Martian Confederate Navy out of the Expanse. Wouldn't that be great? Black with silver piping and red accents and all that. No, they just did camo. And people are going, why would you need camo? Isn't space camo black? And
yeah.
They said, yeah, but all these guys are going to be working on the ground for the next 10 or 15 years, you know? This is a robotic undertaking. Eventually, they may fly people and space fighters, but it's a long ways off, if at all. And it's going to be robotic interdiction and assistance and whatever they're going to do. So, yeah, they're just wearing camos. They can hide inside the mobile units where they're controlling the things, I guess.
Okay. All right. The Space Force. 815 sends in a text that says, I've seen satellites at night. Are you able to see them during the day? And if so, would they leave a vapor trail?
No, because vapor trails is condensing moisture in the air. So they're up above the atmosphere. I don't know that you. I don't think you could see them during the daylight. The brightest thing up there right now is the space station because it's huge, and even that isn't as bright at night as you'd expect. So I never heard of anybody seeing it during the day, and I don't think it's a sufficient magnitude to be seen during the day.
All right. Well, you mentioned Uranus and how it got tipsy. Can we close with that? What happened there?
Sure. So this has been a puzzle for a long time because all the other planets in the solar system rotate perpendicular to the solar system's equator, which is called the ecliptic, so line up from the sun in a big disk, and they spin like tops along that. You know, slight axial tilt, 20, 25 degrees, what have you. Uranus is tipped almost over so that its pole is pointing right at the sun at certain times of its orbit, which is really long. It's like 84 years. But so it's spinning on its side.
Mm.
I thought, well, how did that happen, right? So for decades, the conjecture was something whacked it and spun it over and also sped it up and also got it going the opposite direction because it rotates backwards to the other planets. It's the only one that goes clockwise.
Right, right, right.
So this new study came out and said, well, we don't think so. You know, we think that there might have been an impact of something much smaller, but that because of the way it processes in its orbit, which is that the orbit's elliptical, the ellipse actually moves in a circle around the sun itself. And the resonance between that planet and Saturn and possibly Jupiter, that it causes basically when it was still vertical or some semblance of vertical, that it causes start wobbling like a top. And then also because it has a ring, they think at one time the rings may have been much more massive, and that these combined things cause it to stretch out the equator, begin to wobble, and tip over on its side. And then they got into a bunch of ugly math equations, and my eyes sort of glazed over. But up to that point, it was pretty interesting. So, you know, that whole planet is really bizarre. We've only seen it once close up. That was Voyager 2. And that was a flyby. You're not orbiting. So it's like, okay, we're looking. That's really exciting. Okay, goodbye.
And, right.
So you don't get a ton of data. But it's a fascinating planet because the winds move very quickly. The temperatures are coldest of the solar system in some parts and as hot as 1,000 degrees in other parts.
Wow.
So it's a fascinating, fascinating world that we got to get back to.
Okay. All right. Well,
that's my pitch for another mission to Uranus. I had to say it.
Yeah, of course you did. Absolutely.
Yeah. No matter how you pronounce that planet, it sounds icky.
It does. Yeah, it does. You know, when I was a kid and we were learning about the planets, everybody in the classroom would laugh. You know,
I know, and then they updated. It's okay. We're going to call it Uranus from now on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not much better now, is it?
No, it's not. It's not.
It's just a problem child.
It is.
Yeah.
Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor in chief of Ad Astra magazine, RodPyleBooks.com. You can check him out there. And Space.com is you write for them too.
Yeah, and they're a great outfit. If you get a chance, it's worth clicking in there. It's space for the rest of us. And I just want to give you laud you a bit for the work you're doing. This is a tough time for everybody, and I was watching the live stream before I came on, and you're just handling this wonderful, and I think it's great to have a place to go late at night when we need some reassurance. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Rod. I appreciate that. Thanks very much. Rod Pyle, everybody, we'll talk to you next month.
Take care.
There you go, Rod Pyle, at Astra Magazine, and we love talking space with Rod. All right, Nick DiGilio show continues, and at 2:30 every morning we like to get a laugh in here and play back some classic stand-up comedy from the old Johnny Carson show. And speaking of Johnny Carson show, you can watch it every single night on Antenna TV. They're classic episodes. They're awesome, and it's great that they're on Antenna TV. So we like to play back some stand-up from those classic episodes, and tonight we're going to hear some Tim Allen. And this will go, we're going all the way back to 1991. So a stand-up set from Tim Allen from the Johnny Carson show in 1991 is coming up right here on 720 WGN.